10 minutes after the leading G departed U.S. airspace. The steer from Cheyenne Mountain made the tracking exercise about as difficult as the drive to a local 7-Eleven. A tanker would meet them over the Caribbean after lifting off from Panama, and what had been an interesting air defense exercise reverted to total boredom. The E-3B Sentry, based on the venerable Boeing 707-320B, flew at the identical speed as the business jets made in Savannah, and kept station from 50 miles behind. Only the aerial tanking would interfere with matters, and that not very much. The radar aircraft's call sign was Eagle 2-Niner, and it had satellite radio capability to relay everything, including its radar picture, to NORAD in Colorado. Most of Eagle 2-Niner's crewmen rested in their comfortable seats, many of them dozing off while three controllers worked the four Gulf Streams they were supposed to track. It was soon evident that they were heading somewhere pretty straight, 5 minutes or about 41 miles apart, attempting no deception at all, not even wavetop flying. But that, they knew, would only abuse the airframes and use up gas unnecessarily. It didn't matter to the surveillance aircraft, which could spot a trash bag floating in the water, something they regularly did in counter-drug operations, since that was one of the methods used by smugglers to transfer their cocaine, or even enforce the speed limit on interstate highways, since anything going faster than 80 miles per hour was automatically tracked by the radar computer system until the operator told the computer to ignore it. But now all they had to look at were commercial airliners going and coming in routine daily traffic, plus the four Gulf Streams, who were traveling so normal, straight, and dumb that, as one controller observed, even a Marine could have taken them out without much in the way of guidance. By this time, Clark was on a shuttle flight to Reagan National Airport across the river from Washington. It landed on time, and Clark was met by a CIA employee whose company car was parked outside for the 20-minute ride to Langley and the 7th floor of the old headquarters building. Dmitry Popov had never expected to be inside this particular edifice, even wearing a visitor escort required badge. John handled the introductions. "Welcome," Foley said in his best Russian. "I imagine you've never been here before." "As you have never been to number 2 Dzerzhinsky Square."
"Ah, but I have," Clark responded.
"Right into Sergei Nikolaevich's office, in fact."
"Amazing," Popov responded, sitting down as guided.
"Okay, Ed, where the hell are they now?"
"Over northern Venezuela, heading south, probably for central Brazil. The FAA tells us that they filed a flight plan. It's required by law for Manaus. Rubber tree country, I think. A couple of rivers come together there."
"They told me that there is a facility there, like the one in Kansas, but smaller," Popov informed his hosts.
"Task a satellite to it?" Clark asked the DCI.
"Once we know where it is, sure. The AWACS lost a little ground when it refueled, but it's only 150 miles back now, and that's not a problem. They say the four business jets are just flying normally, cruising right along."
"Once we know where they're going, then what?"
"Not sure," Foley admitted. "I haven't thought it through that far."
"There might not be a good criminal case on this one, Ed."
"Oh?"
"Yeah," Clark confirmed with a nod. "If they're smart, and we have to assume they are, they can destroy all the physical evidence of the crime pretty easily. That leaves witnesses. But who, you suppose, is aboard those four G's heading into Brazil?"
"All the people who know what's been happening." "You'd want to keep that number low for security reasons, wouldn't you? So you think they're going down there for choir practice?"
"What?" Popov asked.
"They need to find and learn a single story to tell the FBI when the interrogations begin," Foley explained. "So they all need to learn the same hymn, and learn to sing it the same way every time."
"What would you do in their place, Ed?" Rainbow Six asked reasonably. Foley nodded. Yeah, that's about it. Okay, what should we do? Clark looked the DCI straight in the eye. Pay them a little visit, maybe?
Who authorizes that? The director of Central Intelligence asked.
I still draw my paychecks from this agency. I report to you, Ed, remember?
Christ, John.
Do I have your permission to get my people together at a suitable staging point?
Where?
Fort Bragg, I suppose, Clark proposed. Foley had to yield to the logic of the moment.
Permission granted.
And with that, Clark walked down the narrow office to a table with a secure phone to call Hereford. Alistair Stanley had bounced back well from his wounds, enough so that he could just about manage a full day in his office without collapsing with exhaustion. Clark's trip to the States had left him in charge of a crippled Rainbow Force, and he was facing problems now that Clark had not yet addressed, like replacements for the two dead troopers. Morale was brittle at the moment. There were still two missing people with whom the survivors had worked intimately, and that was never an easy thing for men to bear, though every morning they were out on the athletic field doing their daily routine. And every afternoon they fired their weapons to stay current and ready for a possible call-up. This was regarded as unlikely, but then none of the missions that Rainbow had carried out had been, in retrospect, very likely. His secure phone started chirping, and Stanley reached to answer it.
Yes, this is Alistair Stanley.
Hi, Al, this is John. I'm in Langley now.
What the bloody hell's been happening, John? Chavez and his people have fallen off the earth, and...
Ding and his people are halfway between Hawaii and California now, Al. They arrested a major conspirator in Sydney.
Very well. What the devil's been going on?
You sitting down, Al?
Yes, John, of course I am, and...
Listen up. I'll give you the short version, Clark commanded, and proceeded to do that for the next 10 minutes.
Bloody hell, Stanley said when his boss stopped talking. You're sure of this?
Damn sure, Al. We are now tracking the conspirators in 4 aircraft. They seem to be heading for central Brazil. Okay, I need you to get all the people together and fly them to Fort Bragg, Pope Air Force Base, North Carolina, with all their gear. Everything, Al. We may be taking a trip down to the jungle to deal decisively with these people.
Understood. I'll try to get things organized here.
Maximum speed?
That is correct. Tell British Airways we need an airplane, Clark went on.
Very well, John. Let me get moving here. In Langley, Clark wondered what would happen next. But before he could decide that, he needed to get all of his assets in place. Okay, Alistair would try to get British Airways to release a spare reserve aircraft to his people for a direct flight to Pope, and from there he'd have to think some more. And he'd have to get there, too, to Special Operations Command with Colonel Little Willie Byron.
Target 1 is descending, a control officer reported over the aircraft's intercom.
The senior controller looked up from the book he was reading, activated his scope, and confirmed the information. He was breaking international law at the moment. Eagle 2-Niner hadn't gotten permission to overfly Brazil, but the air traffic control radar systems down there read his transponder signal as a civilian air cargo flight. The usual ruse, and nobody had challenged them yet. Confirming that information, he got on his satellite radio to report this information to NORAD, and, though he didn't know it, on to CIA. 5 minutes later, Target 2 started doing the same. Also, both aircraft were slowing, allowing Eagle 2-Niner to catch up somewhat. The senior controller told the flight crew to continue on this heading and speed, inquired about fuel state, and learned that they had another 8 hours of flight time. More than enough to return to their home at Tinker Air Force Base outside Oklahoma City.
In England, the British Airways card was played, and the airline, after 10 minutes of checking, assigned Rainbow a 737-700 airliner, which would await their pleasure at Luton, a small commercial airport north of London. They'd have to go there by truck, and those were whistled up from the British Army's transport company at Hereford. It looked like a green sea, John Breitling thought, the top layer of the triple canopy jungle. In the setting sun, he could see the silvery paths of rivers, but almost nothing of the ground itself. This was the richest ecosystem on the planet, and one that he'd never studied in detail. Well, John Breitling thought, now he'd be able to, for the next year or so. Project Alternate was a robust and comfortable facility, with a maintenance staff of 6 people, its own power supply, satellite communications, and ample food. He wondered which of the people on the 4 aircraft might be good cooks. There would be a division of labor here, as at every other project activity, with himself, of course, as the leader. At Binghamton, New York, the maintenance staff was loading a bunch of biohazard-marked containers into the incinerator. It was sure a big furnace, one of the men thought, big enough to cremate a couple of bodies at the same time, and, judging by the thickness of the insulation, a damned hot one. He pulled down the 3-inch-thick door, locked it in place, and punched the ignition button. He could hear the gas jetting it and lighting off from the sparkler things inside, followed by the usual whoosh. There was nothing unusual about this. Horizon Corporation was always disposing of biological material of one sort or another. Maybe it was live AIDS virus, he thought. The company did a lot of work in that area, he'd read. But for the moment, he looked at the papers on his clipboard. 3 sheets of paper from the special order that had been faxed in from Kansas, and every line was checked off. All the containers specified were now ashes. Hell, this incinerator even destroyed the metal lids. And up into the sky went the only physical evidence of the project. The maintenance worker didn't know that. To him, container G7-89-98-00A was just a plastic container. He didn't even know that there was a word such as Shiva. As required, he went to his desktop computer. Everyone here had one, and typed in that he'd eliminated the items on the work order. This information went into Horizon Corporation's internal network, and, though he didn't know it, popped onto a screen in Kansas. There were special instructions with that, and the technician lifted his phone to relay the information to another worker, who relayed it in turn to the phone number identified on the electronically posted notice. "Okay, thank you," Bill Henriksen replied upon hearing the information. He replaced the cabin phone and made his way forward to the Breitlings. "Okay, guys, that was Binghamton. All the Shiva stuff, all the vaccines, everything's been burned up. There is now no real physical evidence that the project ever existed."
"We're supposed to be happy about that?" Carol demanded crossly, looking out her window at the approaching ground.
"No, but I hope you'll be happier than you'd be if you were facing an indictment for conspiracy to commit murder, Doctor."
"He's right, Carol," John said, sadness in his voice. "So close. So damned close."
Well, he consoled himself, he still had resources, and he still had a core of good people. And this setback didn't mean that he'd have to give up his ideals, did it? Not hardly, the chairman of Horizon told himself. Below, under the green sea into which they were descending, was a great diversity of life. He'd justified building Project Alternate to his board for that very reason, to find new chemical compounds in the trees and plants that grew only here. Maybe a cure for cancer. Who could say? He heard the flaps lower, and soon thereafter the landing gear went down.
Another 3 minutes, and they thumped down on the road runway constructed along with the lab and residential buildings. The aircraft's thrust reversers engaged, and it slowed to a gradual stop.
Okay, Target 1 is down on the ground.
The controller read off the exact position, then adjusted his screen's picture. There were buildings there, too.
Well, okay.
And he told the computer to calculate their exact position, which information was immediately relayed to Cheyenne Mountain.
Thank you. Foley wrote the information down on a pad. John, I have exact lat and longe for where they are. I'll task a satellite to get pictures for us. Should have that in, oh, 2 or 3 hours, depending on weather there.
So fast? Popoff asked, looking out the seventh-floor windows at the VIP parking lot.
It's just a computer command, Clark explained.
And the satellites are always up there.
Actually, 3 hours struck him as a long time to wait.
The birds must have been in the wrong places for convenience. Rainbow lifted off the runway at Luton well after midnight, British time, looping around to the right over the automobile assembly plant located just off the airport grounds and heading west for America. British Airways had assigned 3 flight attendants to the flight, and they kept the troopers fed and supplied with drink, which all the soldiers accepted before they settled down as best they could to sleep most of the way across. They had no idea why they were going to America. Stanley hadn't briefed them in on anything yet, though they wondered why they were packing all of their tactical gear. Skies were blessedly clear over the jungles of central Brazil. The first KH-11D went over at 9:30 in the night, local time. Its infrared cameras took a total of 320 frames, plus 97 more in the visible spectrum. These images were immediately cross-loaded to a communications satellite, and from there beamed down to the antenna farm at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, near Washington. From there they went by landline to the National Reconnaissance Office building near Dulles Airport, and from there via another fiber-optic line to CIA headquarters.
"This looks pretty vanilla," the senior duty photo analyst told them in Foley's office. "Buildings here, 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 and this one here. 4 airplanes on the ground. Look like Gulfstream 5s. That one's got a longer wing. Private airfield. It's got lights, but no ILS gear. I expect the fuel tanks are here. Power plant here. Probably a diesel generator system by the look of this exhaust plume.
This building looks residential from the window light pattern.
Somebody build a nature resort we're interested in?" the analyst asked.
"Something like that," Clark confirmed.
"What else?"
"Nothing much for a 90-mile radius. This here used to be a rubber tree plantation, I'd say, but the buildings are not warmed up. And so I'd have to say it's inactive. Not much in the way of civilization. Fires down this way," he pointed. "Campfires. Maybe from indigenous people, Indian tribes or such like."
"That's one lonely place, sir. Must have been a real pain in the ass to build this place, isolated as it is."
"Okay, send us the lacrosse images, too, and when we get good visual light images, I want to see those, too," Foley said.
"We'll have a direct overhead pass on another bird at about 0720 Lima," he said, meaning local time. "Weather forecast looks okay. Ought to get good frames from that pass."
"How wide is this runway?" Clark asked.
"Oh, looks like 7,000 feet long by 300 or so wide, standard width. And they've cut the trees down another 100 yards. Meters, probably, on both sides. So you could get a fair-sized airplane in there if the concrete's thick enough. There's a dock here on the river. It's the Rio Negro, actually, not the Amazon itself. But no boats. I guess that's left over from the construction process."
"I don't see any telephone or power lines," Clark said next.
looking closely at the photo.
No, sir, there ain't none. I guess they depend on satellite and radio comms from this antenna farm.
He paused. Anything else you need?
No, and thanks, Clark told the technician.
Yes, sir, you bet.
The analyst walked out to take the elevator for his basement office.
Learn anything? Foley asked.
He himself knew nothing about running around in jungles, but he knew that Clark did.
Well, we know where they are, and we know about how many of them there are.
What are you planning, John?
I'm not sure yet, Ed, was the honest reply.
Clark wasn't planning much, but he was starting to think. The C-17 thumped down rather hard at Travis Air Force Base in California. Chavez and his companions were rather seriously disoriented by all the travel, but the walk outside the aircraft was, at least, in pleasantly cool air. Chavez pulled out his cell phone and speed-dialed Hereford, then learned that John was in Langley. He had to dredge that number up from his memory, but remembered it after 20 seconds or so, and dialed.
Director's office. This is Domingo Chavez calling for John Clark.
Hold, please, Foley's receptionist replied.
Where are you now, Ding? John asked when he got on the line.
Travis Air Force Base, north of Frisco.
Now where the hell are we supposed to go?
There should be an Air Force VC-20 waiting for you at the DV terminal.
Okay, I'll get over that way.
We don't have any of our gear with us, John. We left Australia in a hurry.
I'll have somebody take care of that.
You get the hell back to D.C., okay?
Yes, sir, Mr. C., Ding acknowledged.
Your guest. What's his name? Gearing?
That's right. Noonan sat with him most of the way. He sang like a fucking canary, John. This thing they planned to do? I mean, if it's real. Jesu Cristo, jefe.
I know, Ding. They've bugged out, by the way.
Where to, do we know?
Brazil.
We know exactly where they are.
I have Al bringing the team across to Fort Bragg. You get to Andrews and we'll get organized.
Rajo, John, let me go find my airplane out.
Chavez killed the phone and waved for a blue U.S. Air Force van that took them to the Distinguished Visitor's Lounge, where they found yet another flight crew waiting for them. Soon thereafter, they boarded the VC-20, the Air Force version of the Gulfstream business jet, and aboard they found out what time it was from the food that the sergeant served them. Breakfast. It had to be early morning, Chavez decided. Then he asked the sergeant for the correct time and reset his watch.
Chapter 39 Harmony.
It struck Noonan as terribly odd that he was traveling with a confessed attempted mass murderer in an aircraft without the man's being in handcuffs or a straitjacket or some sort of restraint. But, as a practical matter, what was he going to do, and where was he going to go? It might be possible to open the door and jump out, but Gearing didn't strike the FBI agent as a suicide risk. And Noonan was damn sure he wasn't going to hijack this aircraft to Cuba. And so Tim Noonan just kept an eye on the prisoner, while considering that he'd arrested the mutt on another continent, in a different time zone and hemisphere, and on the far side of the international dateline. He'd been in on the Fuad Yunus takedown in the eastern Mediterranean 10 or 11 years before. But he figured this might be the FBI's all-time distance record for arresting a subject and bringing the mutt home. Close enough to 12,000 miles. Damn. The price had been the air travel, which had his body thoroughly wrecked and crying out for exercise. He changed the time setting on his watch, then wondered if the day was the same. But, he decided, while you could ask the U.S. Air Force Sergeant Flight Attendant for the time, you'd look like a total fucking idiot to have to ask the date.
Maybe he'd get it from a copy of USA Today back in the States, Noonan thought, pushing his seat back and locking his eyes on the back of Will Gearing's head. Then he realized. He'd have to turn his prisoner in when they got to Washington. But to whom, and on what charge?
Okay, Clark said. They get into Andrews in 2 hours, and then we'll take a puddle jumper to Pope and figure out what to do.
You've got a plan already, John, Foley observed. He'd known Clark long enough to recognize that look in his eyes.
Ed, is this my case to run, or isn't it? He asked the DCI.
Within reason, John. Let's try not to start a nuclear war or anything, shall we?
Ed, can this ever come to trial? What if Breitling ordered the destruction of all the evidence?
It's not hard to do, is it?
Hell, what are we talking about? A few buckets of bio-gunk and some computer records.
There are commercial programs that destroy files thoroughly enough that you can't recover them ever, right?
True, but somebody might have printed stuff up. And a good search. And then what do we have? A global panic when people realize what a biotech company can do if it wants? What good will that do?
Toss in a senior presidential advisor who violated security. Jesus, that would not be very helpful for Jack, would it?
Foley paused.
But we can't murder these people, John. They're U.S. citizens with rights, remember?
I know, Ed. But we can't let them go, and we probably can't prosecute them, can we?
What's that leave?
Clark paused.
I'll try something creative.
What?
John Clark explained his idea.
If they fight back, well then, it makes things easier for us, doesn't it?
20 men against maybe 50?
My 20, actually more like 15, against those feather merchants? Give me a break, Ed. It may be the moral equivalent of murder, but not the legal equivalent.
Foley frowned mightily, worried about what would happen if this ever made the media. But there was no particular reason that it should. The special operations community kept all manner of secrets, many of which would look bad in the public media.
John, he said finally.
Yeah, Ed.
Make sure you don't get caught.
Never happened yet, Ed, Rainbow Six reminded him.
Approved, said the director of Central Intelligence, wondering how the hell he'd ever explain this one to the President of the United States.
Okay, can I use my old office?
Clark had some phone calls to make.
Sure.
Is that all you need? General Sam Wilson asked.
Yes, General, that should do it.
Can I ask what it's for?
Something covert, he heard Clark reply.
That's all you're willing to say?
Sorry, Sam, you can check this out with Ed Foley if you want.
I guess I will, the general's voice rumbled.
Fine with me, sir.
Clark hoped the sir part would assuage his hurt feelings.
It didn't, but Wilson was a pro and knew the rules.
Okay, let me make some phone calls.
The first of them went to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, home of the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, whose commanding officer, a colonel, made the expected objection, which was expectedly overridden. That colonel then lifted a phone of his own and ordered an MH-60K Nighthawk Special Operations helicopter ferried to Pope Air Force Base, along with a maintenance crew for some TDY to a place he didn't know about. The next phone call went to an Air Force officer, who took his notes and said, "Yes, sir," like the good airman he was. Getting the pieces in place was mainly an exercise in electronics, lifting encrypted phones, and giving spooky orders to people who, fortunately, were accustomed to such things. Chavez reflected that he'd come three-quarters of the way around the world, most of it in the last 22 hours, and was landing at an airfield he'd used only once before. There was Air Force One, the VC-25A version of the 747 painted in a scheme known all over the world. And with him was someone who'd planned to kill all the people who'd known it. He'd learned years before not to reflect too much on the things that he did for his country,
and the $82,450 per year that he now earned as a mid-level CIA employee. He had a master's degree in international relations, which he jokingly defined as one country fucking another. But now it wasn't a country, it was a corporation. Since when did they start to think they could play games at this level, he wondered. Maybe it was the New World Order that President Bush had once talked about. If that's what it was, it didn't make sense to the commander of Team 2. Governments were selected, by and large, by the citizens, and answered to them. Corporations answered, if they did so at all, to their shareholders. And that wasn't quite the same thing. Corporations were supposed to be overseen by the governments of the countries in which they were domiciled. But everything was changing now. It was private corporations that developed and defined the tools that people across the world were using. The changing technological world had given immense power to relatively small organizations. And now he was wondering if that was a good thing or not. Well, if people depended on governments for progress, then they'd still be riding horses and steamships around the world. But in this new world order, things had little in the way of controls at all. And that was something somebody should think about, Chavez decided, as the aircraft came to a halt on the Andrews ramp. Yet another anonymous blue U.S. Air Force van appeared at the stairs even before they were fully deployed. "Building up those frequent flyer miles, Domingo?" John asked from the concrete. "I suppose. Am I sprouting feathers yet?" Chavez asked tiredly. "Only one more hop for now." "Where to?" "Bragg." "Then let's do it. I don't want to get too used to standing still if it's just temporary." He needed a shave and a shower, but that too would have to wait until Fort Bragg. Soon they were in yet another Air Force short-haul aircraft, lifting off and heading southwest. This hop was blessedly short, and ended at Pope Air Force Base, which adjoins the home of the 82nd Airborne Infantry Division at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, also home of Delta Force and other special operations units. For the first time, someone had thought what to do with Will Gearing, Noonan saw. Three military policemen carted him off to the base stockade. The rest of the people on the trip ended up in bachelor officers' quarters, more colloquially known as the Q. Chavez wondered if the clothing he stripped off would ever be clean enough to wear again. But then he showered, and, set on the sink in the bathroom, was a razor that allowed him to scrape off a full day's accumulation of black blur on his, he thought, manly face. He emerged to find clothing laid out. "I had the base people run this over." "Thanks, John." Chavez struggled into the white boxers and T-shirt, then selected the forest pattern battle dress uniform, BDU, items laid on the bed, complete to socks and boots. "Long day?" "Shit, John. It's been a long month coming back from Australia." He sat down on the bed, then on reflection lay down on the bedspread. "Now what?" "Brazil." "How come?" "That's where they all went. We tracked them down, and I have overheads of the place where they're camped out."
"So we're going to see them?"
"Yes."
"To do what, John?"
"To settle this thing out once and for all, Domingo."
"Suits me, but is it legal?"
"When did you start worrying about that?"
"I'm a married man, John, and a father, remember? I have to be responsible now, man."
"It's legal enough, Ding," his father-in-law told the younger man.
"Okay, you say so. What happens now?"
"You get a nap. The rest of the team arrives in about half an hour."
"The rest of what team?"
"Everybody who can move and shoot, son."
"Muy bien, jefe," Chavez said, closing his eyes.
The British Airways 737-700 was on the ground for as little time as possible, refueled from an Air Force fuel bowser,
and then lifted off for Dulles International Airport outside Washington, where its presence would not cause much in the way of comment. The Rainbow Troopers were bussed off to a secure location and allowed to continue their rest. That worried some of them slightly. Being allowed to rest implied that rest was something they'd need soon. Clark and Alistair Stanley conferred in a room at Joint Special Operations Command Headquarters, a nondescript building facing a small parking lot.
"So, what gives here?"
asked Colonel William Byron.
Called Little Willie by his uniformed colleagues, Colonel Byron had the most unlikely sobriquet in the United States Army. Fully 6'4" and 230 pounds of lean, hard meat, Byron was the largest man in JSOC. The name dated back to West Point, where he'd grown 6 inches and 30 pounds over 4 years of exercise and wholesome food, and ended up a linebacker on the Army football team that had murdered Navy 35-10 in the Autumn Classic at Philadelphia's Veterans Stadium. His accent was still South Georgia, despite his master's degree in management from Harvard Business School, which was becoming favored in the American military.
"We're taking a trip here," Clark told him, passing the overheads across the table. "We need a helo and not much else."
"Where the hell is this shithole?"
"Brazil, west of Manaus, on the Rio Negro."
"Some facility," Byron observed, putting on the reading glasses that he hated.
"Who built it, and who's there now?"
"The people who wanted to kill the whole fucking world," Clark responded, reaching for his cell phone when it started chirping. Again, he had to wait for the encryption system to handshake with the other end.
"This is Clark," he said finally.
"Ed Foley here, John. The sample was examined by the troops up at Fort Detrick."
"And?"
"And it's a version of the Ebola virus, they say. Modified, engineered is the term they used, as a matter of fact, by the addition of what appears to be cancer genes. They say that makes the little bastard more robust. Moreover, the virus strands were encased in some sort of mini-capsules to help it survive in the open. In other words, John, what your Russian friend told you, it looks like it's fully confirmed."
"What did you do with Dimitri?" Rainbow Six asked.
"A safe house out in Winchester," the DCI replied. "It was the usual place to quarter a foreign national the CIA wanted to protect."
"Oh, the FBI tells me that the Kansas State Police are looking for him on a murder charge. Supposedly he killed one Foster Honeycutt from the state of Montana, or so he has been accused."
"Why don't you have the Bureau tell Kansas that he didn't kill anybody?"
"He was with me the whole time," Clark suggested.
They had to take care of this man, didn't they?
John had already made the conceptual leap of forgetting that Popoff had instigated an attack on his wife and daughter. Business in this case was business, and it wasn't the first time a KGB enemy had turned into a valuable friend.
"Okay, yes, I can do that."
"It was a little white lie," Foley agreed, set against a big black truth. In his Langley, Virginia office, Foley wondered why his hands weren't shaking. These lunatics had not only wanted to kill the whole world, but they'd also had the ability to do so. This was a new development the CIA would have to study in detail, a whole new type of threat, and investigating it would be neither easy nor fun.
"Okay, thanks, Ed."
Clark killed the phone and looked at the others in the room.
"We just confirmed the contents of the chlorine canister. They created a modified form of Ebola for distribution."
"What?" Colonel Byron asked. Clark gave him a 10-minute explanation.
"You're serious, eh?" he asked finally.
"As a heart attack," Clark replied. "They hired Dmitry Popov to interface with terrorists to set up incidents throughout Europe. That was to increase the fear of terrorism,
to get Global Security the consulting contract for the Australians, and...
Bill Henriksen?
Colonel Byron asked.
Hell, I know that guy.
Yeah? Well, his people were supposed to deliver the bug through the fogging cooling system at the Olympic Stadium in Sydney, Willie. Chavez was there in the control room when this Will Gearing guy showed up with the container, and the contents were checked out by the USAMRID guys at Fort Detrick. You know, the FBI could almost make a criminal case out of this.
But not quite, Clark added.
So you're heading down there to...
To talk to them, Willie. Clark finished the statement for him.
They have the aircraft scrubbed yet?
Byron checked his watch.
Ought to.
Then it's time for us to get moving.
Okay. I have BDUs for all your people, John. Sure you don't need a little help?
No, Willie. I appreciate the offer, but we want to keep this one tight, don't we?
I suppose, John.
Byron stood.
Follow me, guys. Those folks you're going to see in Brazil?
Yeah, Clark said.
Give them a special hello for JSOC, will you?
Yes, sir, John promised. We'll do that.
The major aircraft, sitting on the Pope Air Force Base ramp, was an Air Force C-5B Galaxy transport, which the local ground crew had been working on for several hours. All official markings had been painted over, with Horizon Corporation painted in the place of the U.S. Air Force roundels. Even the tail number was gone. The clamshell cargo doors in the rear were being sealed now. Clark and Stanley got there first. The rest of the troops arrived by bus, carrying their personal gear, and they climbed into the passenger compartment aft of the wing box. From that point on, it was just a matter of having the flight crew, dressed in civilian clothing, climb up to the flight deck and commence startup procedures as though they were a commercial flight. A KC-10 tanker would meet up with them south of Jamaica to top off their fuel tanks.
Okay, so that's what seems to have happened, John Breitling told the people assembled in the auditorium. He saw disappointment on the faces of the other 52 people here, but some relief was evident as well. Well, even true believers had consciences, he imagined. Too bad.
What do we do here, John? Steve Berg asked. He'd been one of the senior scientists on the project, developer of the A and B vaccines, who'd also helped to design Shiva. Berg was one of the best people Horizon Corporation had ever hired.
We study the rainforest.
We have destroyed everything of evidentiary value. The Shiva supply is gone. So are the vaccines. So are all the computer records of our laboratory notes and so forth. The only records of the project are what you people have in your heads. In other words, if anybody tries to make a criminal case against us, you just have to keep your mouth shut, and there will be no case.
Bill?
John Breitling gestured to Henriksen, who walked to the podium.
Okay, you know that I used to be in the FBI. I know how they make their criminal cases. Making one against us will not be easy under the best of circumstances. The FBI has to play by the rules, and their strict rules. They must read you your rights, one of which is to have a lawyer present during questioning. All you have to say is, "Yes, I want my lawyer here." If you say that, then they can't even ask you what the time is. Then you call us, and we get a lawyer to you, and the lawyer will tell you right in front of the case agents that you will not talk at all. And he'll tell the agents that you will not talk, and that if they try to make you talk, then they violated all sorts of statutes and Supreme Court decisions. That means that they can get into trouble, and anything you might say cannot be used anywhere. Those are your civil protections. Next, Bill Henriksen went on, we will spend our time here looking at the rich ecosystem around us, and formulating a cover story. That will take us some time, and...
Wait! If we can avoid answering their questions, then...
Why concoct a cover story?
That's easy.
Our lawyers will have to talk some with the United States attorneys. If we generate a plausible cover story, then we can make them go away. If the cops know they can't win, they won't fight. A good cover story will help with that.
Okay, we can say that, yes, we were looking at the Ebola virus because it's a nasty little fucker, and the world needs a cure. Then, maybe, some loony employee decided to kill the world. But we had nothing to do with that.
Why are we here?
We're here to do primary medical research into chemical compounds in the flora and fauna here in the tropical rainforest.
That's legitimate, isn't it?
Heads nodded.
Okay, we'll take our time to construct an ironclad cover story. Then we'll all memorize it. That way, when our lawyers let us talk to the FBI so that we can be cooperative, we give them only information which cannot hurt us, and will, in fact, help us evade the charges that they might hit us with.
People, if we stand together and stick to our scripts, we can't lose. Please believe me on that. We can't lose if we use our heads, okay?
And we can also work on Project 2, Breitling said, resuming the podium.
You are some of the smartest people in the world, and our commitment to our ultimate goal has not changed. We'll be here for a year or so. It's a chance for us to study nature and learn things we need to learn. It will also be a year of working to find a new way to achieve that to which we have dedicated our lives, he went on, seeing nods.
There were already alternate ideas he could investigate, probably. He was still the chairman of the world's foremost biotech company. He still had the best and brightest people in the world working for him. He and they still cared about saving the planet. They'd just have to find something else. And they had the resources and the time to do so.
Okay, Breitling told them with a beaming smile. It's been a long day. Let's all bed down and get some rest. Tomorrow morning I'm going out in the forest to see an ecosystem that we all want to learn about.
The applause moved him. Yes, all of these people cared as much as he did, shared his dedication. And who knew? Maybe there was a way for Project 2 to happen. Bill Henriksen came up to John and Carol during the walk to their rooms.
There is one other potential problem.
What's that?
What if they send a paramilitary team here?
You mean like the army? Carol Breitling asked.
That's right.
We fight them, John responded. We have guns here, don't we?
And that they did.
The Project Alternate Armory had no fewer than 100 German-made G3 military assault rifles, the real sort, able to go full automatic, and quite a few of the people here knew how to shoot.
Yes. Okay, the problem with this is they can't really arrest us legally. But if they do manage to apprehend us and get us back to America, then the courts won't care that the arrests were illegal.
That's a point of American law. Once you're in front of the judge, that's all the judge cares about.
So if people show up, we just have to discourage them.
I think our people won't need much in the way of encouragement to fight back after what those bastards did to the project.
I agree. But we'll just have to see what happens.
Damn, I wish we'd gotten some radar installed here.
Huh? John asked.
They will come, if they come, by helicopter. Too far to walk through the jungle, and boats are too slow. And our people think in terms of helicopters. That's just how they do things.
How do they even know where we are, Bill? Hell, we skipped the country pretty fast,
and they can ask the flight crews where they delivered us. They had to file flight plans to Manaus, and that narrows it down some, doesn't it?
They won't talk.
They're well paid, John objected.
How long before they can figure all that out?
Oh, a couple of days at worst.
2 weeks at best.
I think we ought to get our people trained in defense.
We can start that tomorrow, Henriksen proposed.
Do it, John Breitling agreed.
And let me call home and see if anybody's talked to our pilots. The master suite had its own communications room. Project Alternate was state-of-the-art in many ways, from the medical labs to communications. In the latter case, the antenna farm next to the power-generating facility had its own satellite phone system that also allowed email and electronic access to Horizon Corp's massive internal computer network. Immediately upon arriving in his suite, Breitling flipped on the phone system and called Kansas. He left instructions for the flight crews, now most of the way back home, to inform Alternate if anyone tried to interrogate them regarding their most recent overseas trip. That done, there was little else left to do. Breitling showered and walked into the bedroom and found his wife there.
"It's so sad," Carol observed in the darkness.
"It's goddamned infuriating," John agreed. "We were so fucking close."
"What went wrong?"
"I'm not sure. But I think our friend Popoff found out what we were doing, then he killed the guy who told him about it and skipped. Somehow he told them enough to capture Will Gearing down in Sydney."
"Damn. We were within hours of initiating Phase One," he growled.
"Well, next time we'll be more careful," Carol soothed, reaching to stroke his arm.
Failure or not, it was good to lie in bed with him again.
"What about Will?"
"He's going to have to take his chances. I'll get the best lawyers I can find for him," John promised. "And get him the word to keep his mouth shut." Gearing had stopped talking. Somehow, arriving back in America had awakened in him the idea of civil rights and criminal proceedings. And now he wasn't saying anything to anybody. He sat in his aft-facing seat in the C-5, looking backward at the circular seal that led into the immense void area there in the tail, while these soldiers mainly dozed. Two of them were wide awake, however, and looking right at him all the way while they chatted about something or other. They were loaded for bear, Gearing saw, lots of personal weapons evident here, and others loaded into the cargo area below. Where were they going? Nobody had told him that. Clark, Chavez, and Stanley were in the compartment aft of the flight deck on the massive airlifter. The flight crew was regular Air Force. Most such transports are actually flown by reservists, mainly airline pilots in civilian life, and they kept their distance. They'd been warned by their superiors, the warnings further reinforced by the alteration in the aircraft's exterior paint job. They were civilians now. They were dressed in civilian clothes so as to make the deception plausible to someone. But who would believe that a Lockheed Galaxy was civilian-owned?
"It looks pretty straightforward," Chavez observed.
It was interesting to be an infantryman again. Again a ninja, Ding mused. Again to own the night. Except they were planning to go in the daylight. Question is, will they resist?
"If we're lucky," Clark responded.
"How many of them?"
"They went down in 4 Gulf Streams. Figure a max of 16 people each."
"That's 64, Domingo."
"Weapons?"
"Would you live in the jungle without them?" Clark asked. The answer he anticipated was, "Not very likely."
"But are they trained?" Team 2's commander persisted.
"Most unlikely. These people will be scientist types, but some will know the woods. Maybe some are hunters. I suppose we'll see if Noonan's new toys work as well as he's been telling us."
"I expect so," Chavez agreed.
The good news was that his people were highly trained and well-equipped. Daylight or not, it would be a ninja job.
"I guess you're in overall command?"
"You bet your sweet ass, Domingo," Rainbow Six replied. They stopped talking as the aircraft jolted somewhat, as they flew into the wake turbulence of the KC-10 for aerial refueling.
Clark didn't want to watch the procedure. It had to be the most unnatural act in the world, two massive aircraft mating in midair. Malloy was a few seats farther aft, looking at the satellite overheads as well, along with Lieutenant Harrison. "Looks easy," the junior officer opined. "Yeah, pure vanilla, unless they shoot at us. Then it gets a little exciting," he promised his co-pilot. "We're going to be close to overloading the aircraft," Harrison warned. "That's why it's got two engines, son," the Marine pointed out. It was dark outside. The C-5's flight crew looked down at a surface with few lights after they'd topped off their tanks from the KC-10. But for them it was essentially an airliner flight. The autopilot knew where it was and where it was going, with waypoints programmed in. And 1,000 miles ahead, the airport at Manaus, Brazil, knew they were coming. A special air cargo flight from America, which would need ramp space for a day or so, and refueling services. This information had already been faxed ahead. It wasn't yet dawn when they spotted the runway lights. The pilot, a young major, squirmed erect in his front left seat and slowed the aircraft, making an easy visual approach, while the first lieutenant co-pilot, to his right, watched the instruments and called off altitude and speed numbers. Presently he rotated the nose up and allowed the C-5B to settle onto the runway, with only a minor jolt to tell those aboard that the aircraft wasn't flying anymore. He had a diagram of the airport and taxied off to the far corner of the ramp, then stopped the aircraft and told the loadmaster that it was his turn to go to work. It took a few minutes to get things organized, but then the huge rear doors opened. Then the MH-60K Nighthawk was dragged out into the pre-dawn darkness. Sergeant Nance supervised three other enlisted men from the 160th SOAR as they extended the rotor blades from their stowed position and climbed atop the fuselage to make sure that they were safely locked in place for flight operations. The Nighthawk was fully fueled. Nance installed the M-60 machine gun in its place on the right side and told Colonel Malloy that the aircraft was ready. Malloy and Harrison pre-flighted the helicopter and decided that it was ready to go, then radioed this information to Clark. The last people off the C-5B were the Rainbow Troopers, now dressed in multicolor BDU fatigues, their faces painted in green and brown camouflage makeup. Gearing came down last of all, a bag over his head so that he couldn't see anything. It turned out that they couldn't get everyone aboard. Vega and four others were left behind to watch the helicopter lift off just at first light. The blinking strobes climbed into the air and headed northwest, while the soldiers groused at having to stand in the warm, humid air close to the transport. About that time, an automobile arrived at the aircraft with some forms for the flight crew to fill out. To the surprise of everyone present, no special note was made of the aircraft type. The paint job announced that it was a large, privately owned transport, and the airport personnel accepted this, since all the paperwork seemed to be properly filled out, and therefore had to be true and correct. It was so much like Vietnam, Clark thought, riding in a helicopter over solid treetops of green. But he was not in a Huey this time, and it was nearly 30 years since his first exposure to combat operations. He couldn't remember being very afraid. Tense, yes, but not really afraid. And that struck him as remarkable, looking back now. He was holding one of the suppressed MP-10s, and now, riding in this chopper to battle, it was as though his youth had returned. Until he turned to see the other troops aboard and remarked on how young they all looked. Then reminded himself that they were, in the main, over 30 years of age, and that for them to look young meant that he had to be old. He put that unhappy thought aside and looked out the door past Sergeant Nance and his machine gun. The sky was lightening up now, too much light for them to use their night-vision goggles, but not enough to see very well. He wondered what the weather would be like here. They were right on the equator, and that was jungle down there.